Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our deputy editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
We've got some very exciting films and very exciting guests this week. Director Adam Wingard will be talking about his latest MonsterVerse movie, Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, and Jack Black is talking about Kung Fu Panda 4. We're going to be reviewing those films as well as Mother's Instinct, Drift and Silver Haze. But first, Jordan, have you been watching anything or been up to anything this week besides watching these films?
Yeah, I've been watching a show called Renegade Nell, which is going to debut on Disney Plus in a matter of hours when you hear this. It is the new show from acclaimed screenwriter Sally Wainwright, who, of course, recently wrapped up Happy Valley. So it's quite different for her. It's set in the 18th century. It's about a highway woman called Nell, played by Louisa Harland, who you may remember from Derry Girls. She played Orla in that show. It's a little bit of a cross between sort of Willow and Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, I would sort of say. It's a bit of a romp. It's somewhat slight. I don't think thematically it's got all that much going on, but it's sort of well shot. It's funny. It's sort of slightly dynamic and high impact as well, because as part of the narrative of the show, Nell is sort of given superpowers by this tiny Tinkerbell-sized demon sprite called Billy Blind, played by Nick Mohammed. So there's actually quite a lot of fighting in the show as well. A lot of wire work, a lot of kung fu, stuff like that. So yeah, I've only seen the first few episodes, so I can't speak to the whole season, but I'm sort of enjoying what I've seen so far. And there's sort of, as I say, a sort of supernatural bent to it, which has piqued my interest and looks to be sort of developed further as the show's going on. So yeah, I'll be checking the rest out and hopefully it'll hit the standard of the first few episodes that I've seen.
I must say, not to blow smoke, but you've got an interview piece in the new issue of Total Film on this show. And when I read that, it did really actually intrigue me, to be honest, of something I hadn't really known much about before. But I thought it just sounded like a lot of fun. So I think that's one I will also try and check out when it lands on Disney Plus.
Yeah, it's an interesting one in the sense that obviously Sally Wainwright, best known for things like Happy Valley and Gentleman Jack, it's a script that's been in her drawer for about 15 years, I think. And she just sort of pulled it out after she wrapped up Happy Valley, which is, you know, sort of a very tough show in a lot of ways. And this is just not that at all. It's just very fun. It's very entertaining. It's very silly. There's some dark things that happen in it. And I'd say it's sort of pushing the sort of family-friendly aspect of the fact it's on Disney Plus. And yeah, a couple of people I spoke to described her as like a new kind of Disney hero, which I thought was quite interesting, because even though it's on Disney Plus, I wouldn't really call it a sort of Disney production in a way. It does feel very British and very grounded and just has that earthy fantasy quality that you get from things like Willow. So yeah, I'd say it's worth checking out if you're kind of into that sort of thing. And quite interesting to see Louisa Harland do something very different as well, because I'd only ever seen her in Derry Girls before, and Orla's just like a pure like comic relief character in that show. But here she's like very serious and very stoic and has like a Cockney accent. And yeah, you almost can't tell it's the same person, really. So I was very impressed with her.
Nice. I'm in that slightly sort of douchey, annoying position this week where the couple of other things I've seen besides what we're discussing here are things that are under embargo, so I can't really mention what they are. But
top secret.
I will say that you'll hear interviews from people related to those films in the coming weeks on the podcast, so you will eventually kind of hear about them, just not today. So let's move on to new releases now. And first up, it's time to go back to the Hidden Earth.
For most of human civilization, we believed that life could only exist on the surface of our planet. What else were we wrong about?
Welcome to my world. Won't you come on in?
This is Godzilla Kong, The New Empire. This is the latest film in the MonsterVerse universe, and it follows on directly from Godzilla vs. Kong. Here, the world's two most famous titans, who were trying to take each other out last time, are teaming up to face their biggest threat yet. Now, before me and Jordan review the film, I recently spoke to the film's director, Adam Wingard, and here's what he had to say about putting his own stamp on the franchise and where he drew inspiration from.
Kong can't stop this on his own.
He won't be alone.
Ah!
Right off the bat, I need a definitive answer. How are we pronouncing the title of this film out loud?
Godzilla Kong or GXK, I like to do as well, just because it sounds cool. You know, last film was GVK, so it just kind of rolls off.
Nice. And so, as you mentioned, you previously directed Godzilla versus Kong, which was kind of a culmination of these pre-existing stories. And so did you feel with this film that there was kind of more freedom to explore something new?
Yeah, I mean, for me as a director, being able to follow up, you know, a film that I previously made with all these characters and the sort of the tonal setup that we created in Godzilla versus Kong really gave me a sense of authorship that I felt like I didn't even have in the last movie because, you know, coming in the middle of a series, you know, Godzilla versus Kong was number 4 in the MonsterVerse. You know, you can't help but feel a little bit like a guest. You're kind of standing on the shoulders of giants, you know, to a certain degree, because there's so much great stylization setup has been made through the course of the MonsterVerse before me. But now this being my second film, you know, I take that very seriously, being the first director to do 2 MonsterVerse movies in a row. You know, I just had, you know, the confidence from making GVK to know sort of what type of movie I wanted to do this time. And the most important lesson I got was we could really rely on the VFX to allow us to put you in the monster's point of view and let the monsters tell their story. And we could really like lean into long sequences with no dialogue and no narration and kind of take some interesting chances in a way that I don't think you see very often in blockbuster films. At the same time, we're doing a super fun, crowd-pleasing movie. So it's being able to, you know, do something different, but still deliver on those kind of expectations.
And how was it for you kind of putting more of your own visual stamp on those main characters this time as well?
I'm obviously a child of the 80s, so my influences really, you know, are reflective of that time period. You know, like I grew up on all the Saturday morning cartoons like Thundercats, He-Man, Masters of the Universe. And my gateway sort of to my imagination was the toys and the experience of walking down the toy aisle in the 80s. And so on an aesthetic level, those things really have seeped in. And over the course of my career, I've allowed those things in more and more. And this film is really like the grand culmination of that. And it's not like a total random thing either. Like my association with Godzilla is of being a kid watching these movies. That's when I first discovered Godzilla. And, you know, and that's what I'm sort of trying to get back to, is making a version of these movies for myself as a kid, you know. And that's not as straightforward as it sounds either, because when you're a kid, you want to watch movies that make you feel like an adult. And these movies are actually for adults as well, but you want the adults to feel like kids. You want it to bring back that kind of sense of nostalgia that you had when you first started watching these things. And the sort of visual aesthetic and even the approach of just leaning into the monsters, which is something that I think like every kid when they watch these films wants to see more of, that became my approach.
And so in terms of kind of being inspired by that toy aisle, was that where the gauntlet kind of came from? Were you just thinking of like what would look cool when you were a kid for Kong to have, or did it come from somewhere else?
I knew that I wanted to evolve Godzilla in this movie, and evolving Godzilla is much more straightforward because you know that there's an organic approach you can take to Godzilla and do new things with him. But with Kong, he's definitively an ape, and so, you know, he's not going to evolve in crazy weird directions in a way that you can kind of believably do with Godzilla. But Kong has so closely been associated with humans and throughout all the movies, really. And so I like the idea of evolving him in conjunction with the humans' technology. You know, this is sort of set up a little bit with the idea of them creating Mechagodzilla in the last film. So to a certain degree, it's not like a huge step. You know, if you believe that they can build Mechagodzilla, you would definitely believe that they could build a mechanical kind of arm for Kong to wear. And, you know, whenever I picture all the designs of the characters, I'm not doing it in a way where like I'm creating them for the toys. I don't make any money off the toys, but I do have fun picturing the designs of, do they have the immediacy of what a toy has when it's on the shelf, when you're walking by, you know, like that was sort of the thought process of, you know, when I, you know, made the Scar King and made the arm, you know, like those, the way that they pop, the color wise, Those were inspired in a way by my experience recently, actually, of when GBK came out and going to the toy stores during the pandemic and just realizing how cool it was and how exciting it was for kids to see these, you know, toys on the shelf. And that was something that up until that point, I hadn't really considered when I was making Godzilla versus Kong. You know, they kept us in the loop in terms of what they were doing with the toys, but I was just so busy with the movie. I was just like, whatever. But it was only afterwards that I realized, you know what, this is really a cool thing. And like, there's no other franchises or even personal projects that I can think of making where I would have this opportunity to make something that means so much to kids in this way, and toys included. And so that became an inspiration for me. But, you know, that's a loaded thing in a way, because, you know, some fans, you know, they're worried that you're creating these things just to sell toys, and that's not the case, but the toys are an inspiration. So
these characters obviously have just such a huge legacy. So what are your kind of favorite eras, and what were things you kind of wanted to reflect from those eras in this film?
Oh, by far my favorite eras or era of the Godzilla films are the Showa era. I like the psychedelic, colorful vibe. The, you know, Godzilla versus Hedorah is my favorite of that series because it's the most experimental. It's like the Easy Rider of Godzilla movies, and the, you know, obviously Destroy All Monsters, etc. But I'm also a really big fan of Godzilla versus Destroyer. I think there's a lot of good movies in that period, but, you know, I always kind of go from Showa and then I skip all the way forward to Destroyer. Because Destroyer, it summarizes almost like the whole history of Godzilla in a way. In a way, it's kind of the closest anything's ever been to the Showa films without trying to be. And it's just a really beautiful movie that is very moving at the end. You know, like when Godzilla dies at the end of that film, it's very powerful. And so I always have to include that one on my my list of movies. Like, I can give you my actual list. It'd be, you know, the original Godzilla. You can't deny that one. And I'm not including -1 because it's too new to me, but I would definitely say -1 would be in my top five as well. But -1 aside, I would say the original Godzilla versus Hedorah, Godzilla versus the Astro Monster, Godzilla versus Destroy All Monsters, and then Godzilla versus Destroyer. That's my top five.
And so obviously you mentioned -1 there, and obviously he's kind of doing very well for himself at the moment. So does that feel kind of like, do you feel that success of that film benefits this film?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's kind of crazy because I've been in the MonsterVerse now for 7 years or so. If you count the pre-production on Godzilla versus Kong, Kong Skull Island was still out in the theaters, if you can believe that, when I got hired on. And it's just incredible to see how, you know, Godzilla's just become such a cultural phenomenon right now. Everything's kind of syncing up. And it's interesting how that's kind of syncing up with Oppenheimer winning as well, you know, because obviously the roots of Godzilla, and you see it very clearly in -1, come from, you know, the same sort of story that Oppenheimer's telling. I think it's a good thing, and I'm really happy for Yamazaki. You know, he's such a great guy, and you know, we both, you know, really hit it off the other day. Like, and I was actually surprised how many of our influences within Godzilla are pretty consistent. You know, he's a big Showa era movie fan. He really likes Hedorah. And it turns out both of our cats are a big inspiration in terms of our approach to Godzilla, which is an interesting thing as well.
So that was Adam Wingard. So Jordan, do you want to briefly set up Godzilla Kong, the New Empire for us?
Yeah, so this is the latest film in the MonsterVerse following Godzilla, King of the Monsters, Kong Skull Island, recent Apple TV Plus series Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, and 2021's Godzilla vs. Kong, which New Empire is a direct sequel to, of course. Just to recap where we left things in Godzilla vs. Kong, that Clash of the Titans ends with Big G and King K teaming up to take down Mechagodzilla and sort of going their separate ways, with Godzilla remaining on the surface of the Earth as its protector and Kong returning home to the Hollow Earth, which is this journey to the center of the Earth style world full of Titans and monsters beneath the surface. When we pick things up in the New Empire, that truce is held firm. Kong is still roaming the vast Hollow Earth, a lonely existence for him as he's the last of his kind. Godzilla sort of still springs into life whenever a new Titan threat emerges on the surface. And you have returning human characters like Rebecca Hall's Dr. Andrews, who is still overseeing all Kong studies on Hollow Earth. This story really kicks into gear when a new area of Hollow Earth opens up, which prompts Kong to go exploring. There he finds other ape titans for the first time, including an adorable baby Kong, which I'm sure we'll speak more about soon. But they're all under the rule of an ancient threat called the Scar King, who uses a spinal cord for a whip, and as we learn, once came very close to sort of taking over the surface world until Godzilla drove him underground. So there's history between those two as well. And at the same time, this mysterious signal is leading Godzilla to sort of power himself up by absorbing nuclear radiation and taking down titans along energy lines. And I guess it doesn't really take a genius to work out that it's all going to end up in a big scrap between all the sort of players involved in that. So I quite enjoyed Godzilla versus Kong in 2021. And I'd say this is sort of a similar quality level overall. The big difference between the two films is that The New Empire is much more of a Kong film. Obviously, the main threat is a fellow ape. So you have that connection there. And the bulk of the story is a sort of exploration of Hollow Earth, which is obviously Kong's domain. So you get other characters in his world. He's introduced to this baby Kong, as we say, who appears adorable, but actually has a bit of a of a threatening side, I would say. Don't want to spoil too much. And the Scar King himself is much more of an antagonist for Kong overall, I would say. To the extent that Godzilla almost feels like a bit of a guest star in this film, which I was slightly disappointed by. But when you do get the big Godzilla moments, they are good. You do get a few sort of amusingly played interludes where he goes and takes down a titan and he just makes mincemeat of them in no time at all. And there's quite an amusing running gag about him taking naps in the Colosseum, which I very much enjoyed.
Yes.
But yeah, the bulk of it is this exploration of Hollow Earth. So you have all the human characters going into the surface of it, into the center of the Earth to explore it. Dan Stevens is a new addition in the film here. He plays this kind of daredevil vet who very early on in the film replaces an infected tooth of Kong's, which is quite amusing seeing as he's clearly having a lot of fun here. Obviously, Dan Stevens and Adam Wingard worked together previously on The Guest, so they're very much on the same wavelength of each other. Dan Stevens is doing a very unusual accent in this, I will add. It seems to be the year of unusual accents for Dan Stevens, because he appears to be doing something very odd in Abigail as well, so fair play to him for trying different things. And then you have Brian Tyree Henry returning as well as his podcasting character, his conspiracy theory character, who, despite helping to save the world in Godzilla versus Kong, no one believes him essentially because he has no evidence that he was involved in any of that. So he's pretty much in the same position as he was before. A couple of characters are absent here. You don't get the return of Millie Bobby Brown or Alexander Skarsgård. Neither of which are explained. It's sort of one of those series of films where I don't think they care all that much about continuity and telling you about things that have happened and sort of filling in, dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. You just kind of go along for the ride, and really everyone's just there to see some big monster action, and it sort of does deliver that. So not too many complaints over here.
I had a really similar time with it, really, in that, again, like you, I'd put it on a similar level of Godzilla versus Kong, which I enjoyed. That had the advantage that obviously there was that kind of tension that you were building to this fight between those two, which you kind of lack here, obviously, with Scar King being kind of like a new character and someone we're not kind of particularly invested in. But besides kind of lacking that sort of tension to it, I actually overall maybe enjoyed this one slightly more, because I think this one has found the best balance yet of just leaning fully into the monsters and the fun, kind of minimizing the human characters. Like you say, they've kind of trimmed a few away. We've been left with a few. And what they do is like Dan Stevens is having fun. Brian Tyree Henry's fun. Rebecca Hall is still having this kind of relationship with the adopted child played by Kaylee Hottle. And I found they did have some nice little moments, but then you just really do get the sense that they're aware that people are turning up for the monsters. So they don't try and, like, you know, kind of make the human journey a big part of the film at all. But what they have is fun. Like I say, they each have some nice little moments, but you're here for the monsters and they know it. And as kind of Adam Wingard said in the interview, like, there are some just extended sequences where you're just following beasts. And there was just a sense of fun to it as well, just to use just the obvious word, but just a sense of, like, silly fun. There's just some fun bits early on when you see Kong living his life down there and getting covered in gunk and sort of showering in a waterfall and things like that, which I just enjoyed. So, like you mentioned about Godzilla, kind of where he takes a nap, it's very fun as well. Just basically just leaning into the fun. Like, one of those films that you feel is not making any attempt to kind of convert anyone who isn't into a film that's called Godzilla Kong, that you know if you're going to kind of be on board with this or not. If you kind of don't like the sound of a film about a few massive monsters getting into big fights, you just won't bother with this. And I think they know that. Obviously, again, Adam Wingard kind of obviously mentioned toys and things in that interview, but there is almost like a gleeful sense of like a child playing with toys with this film, I think, in terms of the action scenes. You know, there's some quite inventive stuff there as well. I'll always give a film a bit of a pass as well if I have the vibe that I would have loved this when I was 10. It's sort of, there's just something about it that I just think as a kid, I'd have just thought this was like the best thing ever. Again, just sort of fully leaning into the monsters, going really OTT with that, just giving you all the kind of destruction and fighting that you want in that sense. Obviously, you know, there's quite a lot of monsters in this, so it's just fun, just enjoyable fun. Like, it's not going to kind of convert you, you're not going to win any awards besides, you know, possible
Can you
VFX,
imagine?
but
Best
and
performance.
yeah, but it's just a film you kind of either take on its own terms or you don't really. And I thought if you're in the mood for that kind of film, again, seeing it on a big screen, I'd love to see this in like 4DX. It's like one of those ideal films to see in 4DX where you're just not particularly invested in the characters and the story, but you just want the full rumble and fun, you know, and just a full loud big screen experience with this, I think.
Yeah, it's 100% a film that just leans into the sort of theme park side of movie entertainment. Like, it's not trying to do anything deep or clever. In that sense, it does suffer a tiny bit coming so soon on the heels of Godzilla Minus One, which obviously did tell just a very different sort of compelling human story amid the monsterness, which this film doesn't really at all. It does get like quite complex and quite convoluted, I will say, the human side of things. As they venture deeper into Hollow Earth, they sort of discover more about the past, and there's sort of deeper connections made. And as that sort of expands, I was actually finding myself a tiny bit lost about what was going on. And I was just thinking, can we not just get to the monsters punching each other again? Do we need to do all this? So that was a slightly odd choice, but I guess you can't just have, 120 minutes of Godzilla and Kong fighting other monsters, even though I would 100% be game for that. Like, they do have to have some human characters in there at some point. I joked earlier about, being nominated for best performance, but I was actually pretty impressed with like the animation and the visual effects overall in this, just in the sense that even though obviously Godzilla and Kong just don't speak, like, I just always had a clear sense of what they were thinking, what their motivations were, like what they were doing. And as Adam said in that interview, like, there are just really long stretches where you're just following Kong for like 10, 15 minutes, like going on this odyssey deeper into Hollow Earth. And I did find that stuff like oddly compelling. Like, I love following him as a character. I love the kind of slight redesign he's had in this as well, where he's got this like graying beard and he just looks like a kind of grizzled warrior in this film. Like, there's a bit of like, Bill Money and Unforgiven to him, where he's like the tough guy coming into town and he's facing these new threats. He's trying to clean up the town, essentially, a bit like Dalton in Roadhouse last week. So yeah, I enjoyed that. And then Godzilla likewise gets a similar upgrade in the sense that he's now got this hot pink kind of spinal column, which, don't know, is some kind of upgrade for him, I guess. I didn't really get what his upgrade was, but apparently he's more powerful now.
Looks cool.
Yeah, it just looks really cool, doesn't it? And it is like a very colorful, like very visually impressive film. I saw it at the IMAX in Leicester Square, the Cineworld IMAX, and it's a film that's been shot extensively in IMAX. So whenever they head into the Hollow Earth, the frame expands and it just looks beautiful. And yeah, it is like a real sort of spectacle movie that it's kind of hard to imagine you'll be disappointed if you go and see this on a Friday night, unless you go in expecting, Dune Part 2 standards or something. Then I just can't see anyone not sort of enjoying this.
So if you are on board for this is Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, which is in cinemas from Friday. Next up, it's more fantasy creatures doing battle.
It is time to take the next step on your journey.
I'm not going to be the dragon warrior anymore.
You will advance to spiritual leader of the Valley of Peace.
Inner peace.
Keep your surf off my turf!
Dinner, please. Dinner with peas in a sesame soy glaze.
This is not working at all.
So this is Kung Fu Panda 4, the latest installment in what's proving to be one of DreamWorks Animation's most lucrative franchises. Jack Black is back as Po, The panda who's found spiritual enlightenment and kung fu mastery and is enjoying his status as the dragon warrior. The Furious Five aren't around this time, but instead Po teams up with a Corsac fox called Zhen, who's voiced by Awkwafina, and who may be an ally or a foe. And before me and Jordan discuss the film, we're going to hear from Jack Black himself. I spoke to the comedy legend a couple of weeks ago to talk about the longevity of the franchise, his approach to voice acting, and his incredible cover of a Britney Spears classic that you hear in this film.
Who's that?
The most powerful shape-shifting sorceress, the Chameleon.
How do I find this, the Chameleon?
I'm gonna lead you right to her front door.
Yeah! It was against an army! Yeah!
Then we'll just have to get an army of our own.
What is this place?
The best crooks and criminals live here.
You're a wanted criminal?
You sound surprised. Is it surprising?
This series has been quite a ride for you in the sense that the first film is like 16 years old now. Did you have any sense of the longevity of this franchise when it first started out?
No, I mean, when you first start out, of course you have dreams like, oh, I hope this becomes like a major thing. But you don't look further ahead than the one you're making now. And I was so happy with the way that first one turned out. And the fact that I've been doing it for that long is sort of an amazing testament to the love that the world has for Poe and that universe that we created. And I'm very proud of it.
And what's kind of kept you coming back for more over the years?
I just love it. I love the action adventure. I love the kung fu. I'm a real cinephile in that genre. I love the comedy and the artwork. We've got some of the best artists in the world designing those characters and choreographing those fights. It's just an awesome thing to be part of.
And kind of in this installment, Poe teams up with a new character, a Corsac fox voiced by Awkwafina. And you guys previously worked together on Jumanji The Next Level. Did you actually get to work together here at all, or are you just always recording in isolation?
It's almost all by ourselves, working with the director and working just on our part to make that perfect. And the director is a master of voices, and he would do the other characters and mimic their timing and everything so it all fit together like a puzzle piece. But I did get to work with her on one day, and we did some scenes together, and it was really funny and fun. And I was like, we should do this more if we ever do it again, because we found some new different chemistry that way.
And has your approach to voice acting changed at all the years you've been doing it?
I mean, I've always loved doing it. Maybe I'm a little more relaxed now. When I first started off, I would obsess about certain things and like, oh, I got to try it in every different possible way. And I think I drove the directors insane. I was like, Jack, we got to move on. We got it. The last 32 takes have been exactly the same. Nope, they were a tiny bit different. But now I'm like, no, you're right. And so I'm a little more give and take with the directors, I think. I've matured.
Are you very physical in the recording booth when you're getting Poe's lines down?
You have to be. You have to move when the character moves to make the sound right. Because if you're just relaxed and conversational when you're in the middle of a fight scene and you got dialogue, it just doesn't look right. And that's also the director's job to say, yeah, I'm going to need you to have like a punch or a kick right when you say this word. I sometimes do work up a sweat on the recording sessions, believe it or not.
The villains in the Kung Fu Panda movies.
You're not the first to say Kung Fu Panda, by the way. There's been lots of people saying that.
But you've always had these villains played by these really heavyweight thespians. Like here you've got Viola Davis as the Chameleon. Yeah. What does she bring to this character?
She's one of the greatest actresses in the world, and she brings like a real gravitas to the character, and you believe it when she's talking about her evil plans. And you can tell she loves playing a villain too, so it was really fun and amazing to see her work, and it is perhaps the most terrifying of all the villains that Poe's ever faced. Pretty cool. The Chameleon, shapeshifter.
I've got a six-year-old son who's a big fan of the Kung Fu Panda series and the Super Mario Brothers movie, but I haven't sort of had the heart to tell him yet that Poe and Bowser are actually the same guy. I don't want to ruin that magic for him. Have you had many kids notice that?
No, it's funny you say that though, but they are very different voices and sounds. Bowser being a real character voice that I was doing that's far away from my actual voice. So there hasn't been a problem so far. Yeah, it's cool that I get to voice two different, such different characters from huge animated projects. That's maybe my proudest feather in my cap.
Do children tend to recognize your voice from Poe?
No, children are usually like, that's not the panda. And the parents are like, it is, it's the panda, it's the kung. there's a disconnect, but if I give them a skadoosh, they'll usually go, oh, it is the panda.
Everyone who sees Kung Fu Panda 4 needs to remain seated during the credits, because there's this awesome Tenacious D cover of Baby One More Time, the Britney Spears song. You shared a snippet of that online the other day too. Like, so yes. How did that come about?
Thank you for noticing. Yeah. The director said he wanted a Tenacious D song in the credits. I was like, really? You want Tenacious D in the credits of Kung Fu Panda? I love that. The director's a huge fan. And he was saying, yeah, what covers could you guys do? And he had some ideas. And I was like, nah. And my manager said, you should do Britney Spears. And I thought, whoa, that's a great idea. Because she's got some bangers, like some great songs that also are very unexpected for Tenacious D to do. A hard rock version of Hit Me One More Time just felt like the perfect song for the perfect movie. And I'm so stoked how it turned out. We also got Hans Zimmer on the orchestration of the violins.
Have you had any feedback from Britney on it yet?
No, but I did send her a note. I said, we love the song and we're very proud of the track. And I hope she likes it too. And her manager said she read it and she said, thank you.
And kind of talking of voice acting, you've got Borderlands coming up in which you're doing a voice, but pretty much all the other characters are live action. So what was that experience like? Do you feel kind of a bit of a remove for it, or were you able to still feel very involved?
You know, I love the voice acting. I also love that video game. So it was fun to be able to voice that character. Mm. I think of him kind of like an R-rated R2-D2. He's a cool, fun little turn. And another opportunity to bring a great video game to the silver screen. We're kind of in the middle of a video game movie renaissance right now, and I'm stoked to be a part of it.
I mean, you mentioned that because obviously, yeah, you've obviously done Mario, the Jumanji movies are kind of video game movies, and obviously
kind of
Borderlands and Minecraft.
Super Mario Brothers, yeah.
Are there any video games you haven't adapted yet that you would like to?
You know, the one that seems like a no-brainer that I can't believe they haven't already started making a movie is any of the Rockstar games, the Grand Theft Auto, but especially Red Dead Redemption. Those things are already like movies, you know? I guess that's the thing, is that some video games are already halfway there to telling those kind of stories. And there are some movies that are like video games. Like, did you ever see that Black Mirror motion picture called A Bandersnatch, where you actually choose your own adventure at the end of scenes? It's like, ooh, do you take the red pill or the blue pill? I think we're moving in that way, where there's going to be more combinations of video games and movies, and it's exciting. It's like the beginning of a new era.
So that was Jack Black talking Kung Fu Panda 4. Jordan, do you want to just briefly set the film up for us before we review?
As you sort of touched on in that intro there, as we pick up sort of 8 years later now in the real world since Kung Fu Panda 3, Poe is now not only the Dragon Warrior, but the successor to Oogway as the spiritual leader of the Valley of Peace. And as part of his new promotion, he has to find a successor to become the new Dragon Warrior under the instruction of Shifu, once again voiced by Dustin Hoffman. This doesn't please Poe all that greatly because he really enjoys being the Dragon Warrior. He loves, as he says, kicking butt and taking names, and he doesn't take names all that well. And he just sort of wants to stay as the Dragon Warrior. He doesn't like the idea of being just a slightly boring spiritual leader who doesn't do much fighting. So he's very reluctant to do this. As this is happening, some very strange things are going down in the Valley of Peace. It appears that Tai Lung, who you may remember as the villain voiced by Ian McShane from the first film, has made some kind of return. So Poe goes to investigate this with the help of a Corsite fox called Zheng, voiced by ubiquitous animation voice actor Awkwafina. She's a sort of wily fox, a pickpocket, a thief, an accomplished fighter, but someone who is potentially not very trustworthy. But she's someone who has information on a new threat called the Chameleon. So they sort of team up, go on a bit of a road movie mission to Juniper City, which is this brand new city for the series, very much a sort of metropolis, much bigger than anything we've seen in the series before, where the Chameleon is based, where Poe is heading to take the Chameleon down, essentially. So it's a little bit different for the series in the sense that, as you say, Furious Five aren't really part of this, so you don't have that dynamic going on. Shifu is left back in the Valley of the Peace for most of the film, so you don't have that much between those two characters. Really, it's a sort of buddy road movie between Po and Zheng as they head towards Juniper City and eventually arrive there and meet a bunch of new characters. At the same time, you also have Po's two dads following behind them, so you get a little bit of, you get a kind of doubling up. They're following the footsteps, they're kind of following the destruction that Po and Zheng leave behind them. And eventually it all just kind of culminates in a big showdown with the Chameleon in Juniper City. Personally, massively in the bag for Kung Fu Panda. I'm a simple guy who thinks a rotund panda kicking butt and eating a lot of dumplings is just very funny. So I'm always going to watch these films and almost certainly going to enjoy them. I think this is probably on a par, if not slightly better than certainly 2, maybe even 3 and 1. I did enjoy this quite a bit, I would say. I was chuckling away. I wouldn't say that it reinvents the wheel in terms of the Kung Fu Panda series, or even sort of keeps up with the pace of innovation that's going on elsewhere in the animated space with things like Spider-Verse, of course, and even Puss in Boots, The Last Wish, a fellow sort of DreamWorks stablemate. There's nothing where you kind of look at it and go, wow, they're really sort of pushing the medium and doing interesting things here. It's very much a sort of traditional by the numbers Kung Fu Panda movie with just some very funny jokes, Jack Black performance. One of the things I really do enjoy about the Kung Fu Panda series is that they just are like quite exciting and thrilling fight films. Like some of the fight choreography is pretty decent. Some of the camera work is actually fairly innovative in terms of action camera work. You have like just cameras like stuck to characters as they're like doing impossible spins and things. So the camera moves in these acrobatic dynamic ways and in ways that are often very hard to replicate in live action. So they do some quite cool things with the fights. One of the sort of interesting things in this one compared to previous films is a lot of the action is sort of very vertiginous, like it's very vertical. Like you have a fight in a tavern, which is implausibly mounted on the edge of a cliff, basically. So the tavern's constantly like swinging around and almost falling off. But that fight is like, even though it's very claustrophobic, it takes place over 2 levels. So you're constantly like moving up and down between the 2 levels. And it's just, I just found that really exciting and like actually pretty well staged for sort of an animated fight sequence. And then when you get to Juniper City, you have a sequence which they call the kite fight, where they're sort of being pursued by these bulls, which are essentially the police in Juniper City, and they escape by flying around on these kites. And it's just, yeah, corkscrew camera work, all that kind of stuff, like really interesting stuff. And of course it like looks beautiful, like all these films generally do, very colorful, very just vibrant. And even though it ultimately sort of let me down slightly in the third act, in the sense that I wasn't totally blown away by the place it ultimately goes to, like it just culminates in a pretty like matter of fact, not particularly adventurous sort of way, but I enjoyed it for what it was, and I wouldn't say it's let the franchise down at all. I've watched a lot of the sort of TV versions of Kung Fu Panda. I don't know if you're aware of these. They've made like multiple seasons of many shows, and those are quite weak, and this just felt like, yeah, I can see why this was worthy of the big screen treatment compared to some of those.
I've only recently, through my children, caught some glimpses of the most recent series, which does have Jack Black's voice in. I don't think the previous animated seasons did, so I haven't seen any of those. I've only seen bits and pieces of the Jack Black and Rita Ora series. I largely, just to recap, sort of just felt pretty similar to you, really. I reviewed this for the magazine and website, and I gave it 3 stars overall. Well, I considered it a warm 3 stars. But ultimately, yeah, I thought it was good fun. Jack Black and Awkwafina are people I just literally just find their voices funny. Like anything they could say is pretty funny to me. So I enjoyed it on that level. I actually kind of liked it with the Furious Five not being in it, because they never get a massive look in, or they never get kind of, you know, huge amounts to do individually. So I sort of like the focus this gave it with them not being there. And yeah, and I found the dad's stuff funny as well. It's a very, very slight film, in the sense that if you took out the fight scenes, there's just nothing to it in terms of plot. But then that's obviously its strength as well, that you literally are just barreling from one fun, frenetic fight scene to the next. So it's just always entertaining in that way. Entertaining, funny. I thought the Chameleon was pretty threatening as far as these animated villains go. I thought that was a good villain. I thought it was kind of fun to see some of those characters reintroduced.
I mean, we didn't really explain it, but she has an interesting skill set, in the sense that, like a chameleon, she's a sort of, she can transform herself in a supernatural way. She's a shapeshifter, essentially, and she can become whoever she wants to become. And part of the threat of her is that she's bringing all these old villains back to essentially become this ultimate kung fu master that is eventually going to be an actual threat to Po, as opposed to everyone else who he just effortlessly kind of stomps.
So yeah, so that was fun, and I've seen it twice now. I enjoyed it both times. My children enjoyed it as well, so it obviously plays well to that audience. But yeah, I slightly had the feeling that you basically mentioned this as well, and I touched on this in the review, that because I was so blown away by Puss in Boots: The Last Wish, which was one of these sequels, came a long time after, didn't really have particularly high expectations of it, but it just kind of delivered so much more than it kind of needed to or than you expected it to in terms of like the story, the art style and everything, that this was just, it was just more of the same, which is more of something that I always enjoy, but it just didn't feel like anything particularly different, you know, and especially considering we are meeting Poe kind of at a different stage in his life and a bit further on. I mean, nothing's really moved on in that sense. So it's not like it's a real kind of, you know, turning point for Poe or anything like that. But it was just an enjoyable extra entry into this franchise for me. So that's Kung Fu Panda 4, which is in cinemas now. Next up, it's a battle of a very different kind.
Theo? Theo!
When Theo was born, I couldn't even hold him. Okay, I was afraid I was gonna drop him. I'm a terrible mother.
You're a wonderful mother. And a wonderful friend.
I just want you to be happy, too.
Max? Max, get down. It's not safe. Max! Celine!
Help! Did you ever see a lassie go this way?
Yeah.
Max is gone.
It wasn't easy bringing you into this world. Now you've left her too soon.
Go this way.
You need to separate the grief from the guilt.
What guilt, Alice?
This is Mother's Instinct, which is the tale of two 1960s housewives. Very much feels like we're in sort of like the Mad Men milieu here, like that kind of mid-century modern Stepford Wife type aesthetic. And you've got these two neighbours and friends played by Jessica Chastain and Anne Hathaway. They seem pretty close, but early on in the film, and you know, you kind of glimpse this in the trailer as well, so it's not going to spoil us to say this, there is a sort of a tragedy involving Celine, Anne Hathaway's child. There's a vague implication of Alice, Jessica Chastain, having been involved in it. We're not quite in Anatomy of a Fall's ambiguous territory here, but basically, obviously, this massive tragedy causes a huge rupture between the two. And then it leads to escalating kind of tensions between the neighboring families and suspicions and tension kind of, you know, starting to grow out of control a bit beneath the sort of perfectly manicured facades of these people's lives. So, yeah, so it's the directorial debut of Benoît Delhomme, who was a cinematographer. And it's based on a French language film from 2018, which I haven't seen.
I don't think I even knew it existed, to be honest. Like, it completely passed me by.
And it's also taken, that itself was taken from a book. That's the basics you sort of need to know about this. But did you actually like this film, Jordan?
Not especially. I thought it was pure trash, to be honest. It just really reminded me of those early 90s thrillers, Single White Female, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, like all that stuff. We're just operating in that register. It's totally melodramatic. It's just hysterical. It's just very silly. Everything is just overblown and daft. I was just laughing at like a lot of it just because it was just so ridiculous. There's just a scene very early on where Jessica Chastain and her husband character, they go over to the house after Anne Hathaway's son has died, and they go over for the first time to like comfort them, and the husband of Anne Hathaway's character like gives the dad, the husband of Jessica Chastain's character, like a big hug, like a big bear hug, like, oh, so terrible this happened, I'm so glad you're here. The way that he reacts to Jessica Chastain, because there's this initial like resentment of her for not having saved their son, it's just so daft and stupid, just like this plays its hand like far too clearly. Like, there's just no subtlety to the whole thing at all. If these people had like any sort of conversation at any point, like, it would easily be solved, everything that's going on. Just all very stupid and very silly. The one thing I will say is that I actually thought that Anne Hathaway was pretty good in this. Like, I just thought she knew exactly the type of film that she was in, and she played it absolutely correctly. She's just a lot of fun as that kind of seething, just very bitter mother who just, you never quite know what's going on. The one thing it does do is it doesn't make it absolutely clear what's going on in Celine's head all the time. Like, you're not 100% sure which way she's going to go at points. And I did think that she played, you know, the critical moment at the beginning of the film, like really well. Like I just had that moment where just my heart just leapt into my throat when you realize what's happening, just because of the way that she sells it. Like it all just totally rests on her. So I thought she did a fantastic job. I thought Jess was okay, serviceable, I would say, sort of slightly outshone by Anne ultimately. But I just wasn't a big fan of this. Like if I wanted to see this type of film, I would just go back and watch one of those like cult classics from the 90s, because they're just so much more entertaining than this. I just knew where this was going almost from the first frame, and it didn't really do anything to surprise me.
Yeah, especially if you've seen the trailer, there's not really much to surprise you. The trailer is one of those ones that really just trims it down and sums it up immensely. So kind of avoid that if you can. But
It's like a fairly brief film as well, like a brisk film. Like one of the things I did appreciate is that the inciting event happens about 5 minutes in. Like there's no like long-winded build up to it. They really get into it straight away, and that I did respect a lot. But tonally, it just wasn't what I wanted from this. Like I could see this just being a much better film if it was just like a subject that was treated a lot more seriously. Like if there was like a proper indie movie kitchen sinky approach to it, like I could see that's just being so much more powerful and effective. Here it's just like beach potboiler stuff basically.
The thing is, I don't have a huge amount to add really different to what you said, but I perhaps enjoyed it a tiny bit more than you, in that I kind of appreciated that throwback quality of it and thought it sort of, you know, it looked nice. Like the performances, like the kind of tone and way. And it's obviously like, it's a horrible thing to even sort of contemplate, isn't it? You know, the whole premise, it's just kind of nightmarish. Awesome, yeah. But in some ways as well, like maybe you have this feeling that it could have gone further into the campiness and the sort of silliness of it. Perhaps it's almost a bit somewhere between two stools, maybe, where like you were saying, it's not right. It's not enough of a kind of like heavyweight drama in terms of dealing with that topic, but it's also not quite kind of knowingly funny enough to be just like a retro campy throwback take on this sort of material. So it perhaps falls between two stools.
I think you've probably nailed what the issue I sort of had with it, really. I could see like a sort of Todd Haynes like just doing a fantastic job with something like this. Like it just plays it just like too straight. It just doesn't push it into the place it needs to go for what it ultimately is. Kind of, very much stuck between two stools. I will say, like, respect to Benoit Delhomme, 63 years old, making his directorial debut. Shows it's never too late, to step up. Yeah, like, fair play.
Fair play to him. Well, yeah, good on you, Benoit. So that was Mother's Instinct, which is in cinemas now, having opened on Wednesday. So next up, we've got an alternative perspective on the refugee story.
From
Liberia.
Along the way, I feel I smile. Oh, no, it would always be like this.
So that is Drift, and this is the story of Jacqueline, played by Cynthia Erivo, who's a refugee, a Liberian refugee. And when we find her, she's kind of like living near enough off the grid, kind of homeless, no money, just one set of clothes to her name, on this Greek island that's actually, I mean, it's a really beautiful setting. And it's one of the interesting things about this film that it does give a slightly different take on the refugee experience than what I've kind of seen previously, in the sense that, I mean, where she's ended up is a kind of beautiful location, obviously, although she's kind of carving out this really hard scrabble existence. And it's interestingly done in that in this sort of present timeline, we see her kind of, you know, like eking out an existence on this Greek island where she's eating from sugar packets to kind of keep herself going. She's kind of giving foot massages on the beach to earn just like a few euros here and there to kind of keep her going. She's trying various things, you know, in order to kind of get a bit of food even. And she kind of lives in this sort of cave where she's got this makeshift bed sort of made from pebbles. And she kind of, you know, washes her sort of one set of clothes each evening in the water. During this timeline, she kind of meets a tour guide played by Aaliyah Shawkat. And they sort of basically begin this kind of friendship. This sort of relationship blossoms between them. There's this connection between Jacqueline and Callie, Aaliyah Shawkat's character, and it kind of teases out Jacqueline's backstory really from there, and we kind of see glimpses of what happened to her basically to lead to this point, and glimpses of her kind of past lives and the family time in Liberia, sometimes she spent living in England. She's kind of has an English accent, so she's able to sort of use that to get around and use that to, in certain situations. And we sort of see what ultimately kind of caused her to flee Liberia as well. I know you haven't seen this one yet, Jordan. So to kind of then lean into the review side of things, it's one of those films I found it kind of interesting and sort of, you know, I was engaged while watching it. And like I say, partly it's this kind of interesting setting, interesting sort of type of refugee story I hadn't really felt like I'd seen before. And then you've got at the centre, Cynthia Erivo, who is, you know, don't need me to say, like, immensely talented, obviously. And she's kind of going to be really widely seen in the first part of the Wicked movie adaptation, which is coming out later this year. It's kind of arguably her first proper like blockbuster role, but she's kind of, you know, done great things in like Widows, Bad Times at the El Royale, Harriet, the Harriet Tubman film. She was in the Luther movie as well. You know, she's done a lot, and she's basically always really good. And she's one of those people who's got three quarters of an EGOT as well. So she's obviously been kind of celebrated for her talents over the years. So she's kind of great, and she's kind of like a powerful center of the film. And as a sort of like long time Arrested Development fan, I'm always a fan of Elia Shawcat as well. I think she's just like just someone who's just so easy to sort of warm to on screen. So I kind of like those. But I thought in kind of both aspects of the story, I often just had this slight feeling that I just wasn't getting quite enough. Like I wasn't getting quite enough kind of meat when it came to this connection between Jacqueline and Callie. And the flashbacks were occasionally frustrating in that you got so little kind of parceled out and given back to you, that sometimes I just felt like I was really grasping for just a bit more context in terms of like the character and in terms of like the geographical situation and the timeline of the situation. For that reason, I didn't get fully invested and fully on board, even though I kind of appreciated it and thought it was, you know, permanently interesting and kind of engaging. But yeah, for that reason, it never quite took me to that next level of connection personally.
Yeah, it sounds interesting. Like, I'm always interested to see what Elia Shawcat's up to. Like, I think she's just a very sort of compelling screen presence, and it seems like not the typical thing she does. She tends to lean into the more comedy side of things. So yeah, I'm interested to see a more dramatic turn from her, especially.
So that was Drift. So if you do fancy seeing that and keeping up with the work of Cynthia Erivo and Elia Shawcat, that's in cinemas from Friday. And now it's time for our final film of the week.
Hello. What happened to you? I was in a fire when I was a kid. I've just got a message from someone saying that Jane's confessed to starting the fire.
What have you been doing?
What's your problem?
Scared?
Nervous.
Why?
What did she do again? Stop asking me questions!
So, Florence, where are you from?
This is Silver Haze. Jordan, could you set this one up for us, please?
Yeah, this is written and directed by Sasha Pollock. She's a Dutch filmmaker who previously directed a film called Dirty God in 2019. Like that film, Silver Haze stars Vicky Knight. Vicky is a real-life burn victim, and her real story sort of blends into the narrative of the film here, because the character she plays, Frankie, is also a burn victim who was trapped in a pub fire when she was 15 years old. And this picks up many years later, sort of 10 years later, at a point where she's still sort of obviously not over it. There's a sort of question about how the fire started, who is to blame. She's never had answers about it, and she's very much resentful about that situation. She's currently working as a nurse, and as part of her job, she comes across a character called Florence, played by Esme Creed-Miles, daughter of Charlie, who was previously in the Hannah TV show on Amazon. Florence is a suicide survivor. She's mentally clearly not well, but the two sort of form a strange sort of dangerously self-destructive connection, and they start a relationship. They find solace in each other initially, but that connection starts to turn a little bit bitter. They start to push themselves into places which aren't the best for each other. And at the same time, Frankie is trying to reconcile with the fact that her estranged father has moved on with his life and has started a new family, got a new wife, has a new child, which is entirely separate from her, and she feels she's been sort of left behind. So it's a very intense drama in a way, in the sense that obviously the themes are extremely heavy, and you have this character in Frankie, who just the real life resonance of the fact that Vicky Knight is a person who is covered in scars herself. You can just read like the effect of these events on her life, just all over her body, like literally. It's sort of a very interesting thing to do when people take elements from their own life and feed them into a fictional narrative like this. And it is quite effective in that sense. the sort of Florence connection relationship side of things was sort of compelling for me up to a point, and then sort of fizzles out in quite a strange and underwhelming way towards the end, where you ultimately sort of question what the whole point of this character being introduced into the film was at the end of the day, because it's quite sort of separate to the main thrust of the story. But Esme Cree Miles is just a very sort of charismatic screen presence. I have to admit, I hadn't actually seen her in anything before, and she's just like a very sort of striking person. I can absolutely see her going on to do like even bigger things than this in the future. And Vicky Knight is just, yeah, an exceptional performer. You can just feel the trauma and the tragedy just all over her. She plays it really beautifully. Ultimately, I did feel it didn't quite hang together as a complete story. It felt like, sort of, I guess in a sort of true to life way, when people just have a lot of things going on in their life and it doesn't always just feed into one singular focused storyline. She just has a lot going on, and some of it is just ultimately irrelevant to the final destination we reach, and some of it is connected directly. And I just felt like a more like traditional focused screenplay would have whittled some of that down and emphasized other elements. But yeah, well performed, sort of well shot, obviously sort of shot in and around sort of the southeast of England, essentially. It all like feels authentic in a way. But I wouldn't say it's absolutely essential, but two sort of great performances and a very promising sort of young filmmaker who's already done very good work. So if it's the kind of thing that sort of piques your interest to see potential superstars in the future, then yeah, I'd definitely go and check it out.
Well, I'm intrigued to check it out for that reason alone. And that was Silver Haze, which is in cinemas from Friday. So Jordan, what is your film of the week this week?
Yeah, tough one. There's a few I enjoyed that were all on a sort of similar level for me. Silver Haze and Godzilla Kong, The New Empire, both good in different ways. But I'm going to give it to Kung Fu Panda 4 because, yeah, I just love me a panda doing Kung Fu.
It's very close for me between Kung Fu Panda 4 and GXK, but I think I'll go for GXK just because I think that's the one that's more essential to see while it's in the cinemas. Like, you'll probably, you know, end up having multiple opportunities to watch Kung Fu Panda 4 at home if you've got kids. So I think Godzilla Kong is the one to see on the big screen for me. So we're approaching the end of the podcast now, but do look out for the new issue of Total Film featuring The Fall Guy, which is on sale now. I spoke to Ryan Gosling, Emily Blunt, David Leitch and Kelly McCormick for that. And there's loads more great stuff in the issue, including a big deep dive into the new Apes movie, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, plus loads more great interviews, including John Krasinski by Jordan, that was, Melanie Lynskey and Jerry Seinfeld. And if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice to help others find us. And remember, you can always contact us on our social media channels or email us at totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, time for a quick question. Jordan, this came to me after having Godzilla Kong, The New Empire and Kung Fu Panda 4 this week. But do you prefer your sequels to have sort of subtitles, or do you just like a straightforward numbering when it comes to a sequel?
Can I go for option three, which is I prefer to have my sequels pluralized in the sort of aliens, predators, twisters mold.
Nice.
I mean, I've said this many times on the podcast before, but Aliens is my favorite film of all time. So obviously I'm going to be in the bag for pluralized sequel names. Yeah, I think it just comes down to like the content of the film in a way, because I like a numbered sequel when it's just all part of a very continuous series and everything sort of feels the same and you sort of know you're getting more of the same. But I prefer like a subtitle when they're doing something quite different with it.
Yeah.
Like I enjoyed when Marvel moved more towards subtitled names, because The Winter Soldier is just a very different film from Civil War. So it makes sense not to call those films Captain America 2 and 3 because the subject of them is very different. But Iron Man 2 and 3, I'm fine with that. Like, that's all good. I'm cool either way, but I like there to be a good reason why it's numbered and why it's subtitled and why it may be pluralized.
I'm similar, really. I don't have a great deal to add to that, but one of my favorites ever, and again my favorite film, mine being, I loved it when it went from Batman Begins to The Dark Knight and then The Dark Knight Rises. That's the ideal for me in terms of kind of naming sequels.
I initially reacted to The Dark Knight Rises as a bit like like I wanted them to do something completely different again, not have The Dark Knight in the title. Yeah. Like, I understand why you want to have the words The Dark Knight in the title after you've released that film. But
did you want to have Caped Crusader in the title?
Yeah, exactly. Do something different again. But
Caped Crusader conclusion.
Exactly. Fair play. They knew what they were doing. They made a lot of money.
And I don't really like a sort of meaningless subtitle. That's one. That's my biggest pet peeve, when it's just like a completely meaningless subtitle. Yeah. It just has no real bearing on the film, or when we just get into this territory where we've got so many colons and dashes and things like that. It's like, you know, you have title, subtitle, like just don't go any kind of further like that. Or if you have like a really, I always found this with the Pirates of the Caribbean films, because Pirates of the Caribbean is like a longish title for a film to begin with. That then when you start whacking unwieldy subtitles on those, it's like, come on, like, it's just too much.
And then you had that sort of almost inexplicable thing with later films where they had two different subtitles in different territories. So you had like Salazar's Revenge and Dead Men Tell No Tales in like different countries. So not only does it have a very, very long-winded title, it's got two different titles around the world. Yeah. Oh my God, how are we supposed to keep track of all this? I also love a part one, or a part two, I should say. I like when they stick the part in, because it's sort of in that Godfather-y way. It just makes you think, yeah, this is going to be like the direct continuation. Recently, we had that with Dune Part Two, obviously. Mm. A Quiet Place Part Two. I always think like a part two just sounds really classy as well.
I was just literally going to add that. Yeah, it's just got you know, they're trying to do something classy at least when they go for part two, aren't they? You know. And I just have very fond memories of Back to the Future Part 2 and 3. It just sounded cool when I was younger, you know. So just 100%. Sounded like, yeah, there's something about it. It just sounded like a cut above just a standard 2.
I know you know this as well, but the sequel to The Last of Us, the video game, is called The Last of Us Part 2. So I'm curious if they're going to call Season 2 of the show The Last of Us Part 2. Because have we ever had a Part 2 TV show?
I think that could actually be
the first ever.
We'll see. So if you have any thoughts on titles, do let us know. But that's all from us this week. So thanks very much for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.